Welcome to the Free From Wall Street podcast, where we talk about how to create, preserve, and pass on generational wealth without the roller coaster ride of the stock market. And now, here's your host, Stephen Libman, managing partner of Integrity Holdings Group.
Welcome back to the Free From Wall Street podcast. We got Gabriel Hamill with us today. Thanks a lot, man, for taking the time to sit down and talk to us a little bit about what you got going on.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on your show.
Yeah, absolutely. So a little bit of interesting times. Everybody's still on lockdown, quarantine, coronavirus. It's April 3rd at this point. So how are you guys making it through this time, and what's changed? What's a little different?
Yeah, so far so good. I mean, I don't think we've seen anything yet as far as what the major impacts are going to be economically. But that being said, I think there's going to be a lot of opportunity as well. I heavily invest in real estate, and I think there'll be some opportunities there. Just making sure I'm keeping my eyes open and my brain on to take advantage and see those opportunities as they present themselves.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about your background.
Sure.
So you said you're heavily invested in real estate. So what kind of real estate are you into? How'd you get into it?
Yeah, mostly multifamily, residential stuff, some mixed use and commercial too. But I got into it, I was a couple of years out of high school, really didn't have a lot of direction. I had joined the Army National Guard my senior year of high school. So 99, went to basic training in 2000. And around 2002, I read Rich Dad Poor Dad for the first time, and
sure,
it just changed my life. I used to be embarrassed to say it, but I'd never really read a book word for word, cover to cover, never picked up something that really just engaged me. And so I started reading that book, and I was like, yes, this makes sense. This is what I want to do. Kind of always attracted to business, but I kind of viewed it very differently prior to reading that book. And so just opened my mind up to financial freedom. And I was determined I would do that through real estate. And about a year or so after reading that book, I was deployed to Iraq. And so 2003 and 2004, I spent my time in Kuwait and Iraq. And I just thought a lot about the lessons in that book. And, I was determined I'm going to come back. I'm going to start buying investment property. And so shortly after coming back, as soon as I got back, I just started looking for property and talking to people about what I wanted to do. A lot of people thought I was crazy. A lot of my friends that I was in the military with were like, how the hell are you going to go buy investment property? You don't have money. You don't have any kind of education. And I said, I don't know how, but I'm going to do it. So I went to a bank 2005. They gave me a loan with no job and no money. And that was, that was during the subprime. And so 2005, I thought, hey, that's pretty easy, right? I rented out two of the bedrooms and lived for less than I could have lived anywhere else. So, kind of the same thing in 2006 and 2007. The banks were willing to just give no money down loans. My third loan was a 5% down loan. And then everything kind of came to a halt. 2008, I went back to the bank. I had opened up a small nutrition store in that time too. So 2008, my store really wasn't making money. My first son was born. And I thought, like, what am I going to do? And I had those couple houses, they cash flowed a little bit, but I went back to the bank and said, hey, I want to buy another house. And they said, hey, slow down. We're not doing these no money down loans anymore. You need like 30% down, and you need income and a job and such. And I said, but I have these other houses. They said, we don't care. Things have changed a lot. And so, I really had to shift and decide, hey, do I want to really pursue this? How am I going to pursue this? Or go just get a job. So I did take a lot of random kind of odd and end, low paying, minimum wage type jobs. And then ultimately decided I would start really getting after the real estate by means of seller financing. And so 2009, I did my first seller financing deal. And that was kind of the beginning to putting a lot of seller financing deals together.
So let's talk about that. So where are most of those deals located? Are they in Oregon?
Yeah, almost really all my properties are in Oregon. I live in Eugene, about 100 miles south of Portland, and the majority of my properties are within 15 minutes of where I live.
There we go. I think we're back. There. All right. So yeah, those are located in Oregon.
Correct. Yep.
And then, so seller finance is nothing that I've ever done in New Jersey. We, you know, even when we had the wholesale and fix and flip business, I know a lot of guys that are really successful in this space, but you can't really do it in New Jersey. Just the landlord tenant laws, and we're a judicial state. Everything is run through the judiciary. Loans aren't really assumable here. So we've never kind of implemented this strategy here. So tell me a little bit about that. What's it look like? How are you finding the sellers, and then what's the negotiation, and what's the end benefit?
Yeah. Yeah. So early on, you know, when the bank said, "Hey, no, you can't, we're not going to give you another bank loan," I just thought, hey, there had to be another way. And I remember reading briefly just about seller financing, about other means of financing a real estate deal. And so, I didn't know a lot about it, but I knew there was an opportunity there. And so seller financing is really, rather than getting a bank loan or paying cash for a property, you're getting the seller to become the bank, essentially. So in most cases, not all, but in a lot of cases, the seller owns the property free and clear, and they become the bank. So you're making your mortgage payments directly to them rather than going out and getting a bank loan. And so there's a lot of advantages as the buyer. So for me, initially, I was just on Craigslist every day typing in words like seller financing, owner financing, you know, seller carry, and just seeing, you know, were there anybody interested in carrying financing. And initially, I wasn't finding anybody, and eventually I found a woman that had two duplexes side by side. She was offering seller financing. It was a low money down deal. And as I started doing more of these seller financing deals, I realized it was a huge advantage to the seller as well, because they become the bank. They're earning interest on a property that they've already, in most cases, paid off. And so, you know, you write up a note and trust deed, just and it gets recorded with the county, just like you would if you got a bank loan. And so, early on, I thought, oh my gosh, I have to go talk and convince all these sellers into why it's advantageous for them to carry financing. But I realized that every seller who carried financing, they already wanted to carry financing. They already understood the advantage of being the bank and earning interest. I've never, even to this day, I've never had to educate or convince or talk a seller into carrying financing. It's typically, you know, men and women in their 60s and 70s, they've managed the properties themselves. They have a significant amount of wealth they've built up with the real estate. They usually have multiple properties, and they want kind of that next level of passivity. So they become the bank. They're not dealing with tenants. They're not dealing with turnover. You know, they are the bank, and you make your payment to them rather than making it to, say, Wells Fargo or Bank of America.
Yeah, and it becomes a bond or an annuity for them, right? They're getting a monthly cash flow every month, and it's stable, it's consistent, and they're in first lien position, right? So
yep.
I've heard some other guys talk about how they do it with existing mortgages. That's where it kind of gets gray, I think, in New Jersey. But that strategy would work in any state. I mean, if they own it free and clear and people are looking to sell their finance. So what are your typical terms on that? You'll give them some money down, and then you guys will negotiate the rate.
Yeah, it really varies. So early on, I had no money. And so I found that sellers were either stuck on price, down payment, or interest rate, but it was never all three. And so for me, I was really down payment sensitive. I just didn't have, you know, money for a down payment. And so I looked for sellers and I kind of found this naturally as I would ask sellers questions, you know, like, hey, what kind of terms are you looking for? And I negotiated it very informally like that. Like, hey, what would be the, you know, ideal scenario for you on a seller financing deal? And sometimes they would come back with, oh, I need 50% down, or they'd be crazy terms. But a lot of times they weren't interested in a down payment. And so they were more interested in having that consistent monthly payment. So early on, 2009, 10, 11, 12, 13, almost every one of the deals I did were no money down, with the exception of a couple lower money down deals, you know, $10,000 and such. And so it just really depends on the seller. And so kind of the way I take it on is I just ask the basic questions like, hey, what is it that you're looking for? I try to find out what the seller's needs are. And then if I can give them as much of what they want and still make the deal work, that's kind of how I negotiate it.
So you're looking at, you know, you're calculating your monthly payment, what the mortgage, taxes, principal, interest, all that is going to be. And then you know the rental market, and you're arbitraging the difference.
Exactly. Yeah. I have to be cash flow positive. Like early on, it had to be cash flow positive. Now, if it was no money down, any positive cash flow, that's an infinite return. Sure. Obviously as I'm putting money down and I'm doing larger deals now, I look at my cash on cash return. And if I'm putting significant money into a deal, I want to know what my return on that money is. But early on, I didn't speculate in the sense of, I had to increase rents, right? So I'd buy, there's a particular neighborhood that was up and coming and I knew people wanted to live there. I knew there was some value add opportunities. These were homes that were kind of, my criteria was poorly managed, under rented, deferred maintenance. So I knew there was that upside potential, but I never banked on that. I always looked at, what is this property doing today? What has it been doing? If I do nothing else, is it cash flow positive? And so I speculated in the sense of, yes, I knew there was opportunity for growth and such, but I never banked on that. I've always looked at appreciation and upside rent potential as a bonus on what the property is and how the property is currently performing.
Yeah, that makes sense. So fast forward, I mean, now you guys are owning, how many units do you own, and are they mostly single families, duplexes, quads?
It's a mix. So I have a little over 175 units. About roughly 100 of those are a mix of single family, small multifamily, and the other 75 or so are between two mobile home parks. So okay. I have a 43 unit mobile home park, a 37 unit mobile home park, and then the rest is really just a mix of mostly medium and small multifamily.
And then who's managing that on the day-to-day basis for you?
Yeah, all third-party property management. So early on, I was managing my own property, just
changing out toilets. It. Yeah.
trying. No, yeah. And that's, I realize, I love putting deals together. I enjoy it. I enjoy, networking, meeting people, building relationships, analyzing deals. I do not enjoy property management. So, early on, I had 17 units. I'm trying to fix a toilet. I wasn't that handy. It's like 10 o'clock at night. I'm trying to get this done so the tenant can go to bed. I have young ones at home. My wife's at home. I had to call a plumber anyway. So it was my time and my money spent, right? And finally, I was like, all right, it's time to turn it over to property management. Good property management should add value to you as the owner and, of course, to the properties. And unfortunately, a lot of the management companies out there are not great, But I've been fortunate for the most part to have good property management and that's added a lot of value to my business for sure.
What's that typically cost for those types of deals? I've heard anywhere between 5% and 10%. Where are you seeing most?
I would say between five and 10%. So I typically pay between 5% and 7%. It just with the economies of scale and such. Here most management companies will charge 10% if you bring them a property. But that's very negotiable if you're bringing them a portfolio of properties.
And you're just building that into your underwriting. So it's not like it's a surprise. I mean, that's going to be a fixed cost. And, if you're building your business to be hands-off, then you need to just build that into your offer price.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, even early on when I was doing those first couple deals, I always factored in 10% because I knew really quick, like really early, that I didn't want to manage properties. I wanted to put more deals together. In fact, the month really that I turned everything over to property management, it freed up so much of my time to go put more deals together. So I'd always factor that in, kind of knowing, hey, I will eventually turn it over to property management.
Yeah. And just for our listeners, I mean, as you grow and scale, just like Gabriel was saying, you can negotiate those prices. I mean, we're buying a 220 unit complex right now, and we're going to pay 4% in property management on that. But the 66 units, we pay 5%. So, and we should be, we have some deals under contract too, but once we get over 1,000 units, it changes the perspective, right? And it's just economies of scale. Sure. I mean, these guys can live in one area and manage a lot of your property. So,
exactly.
But even 10% for a single, I mean, that's very reasonable when you start calculating how much you should get paid as the owner and what your time is worth. It was years ago that we sat down and we said, okay, well, what do I want to make a year, right? Like, what's that number? Everybody has a magic number. Well, if this is my number and I can break that out over how many hours I want to work, everybody's like, well, divide it by 40 hours. Well, I don't want to work 40 hours a week. So, I have to divide it out by 25 hours a week. And then I can come up with my hourly wage and does it make sense for me to go and swap a toilet out or pay the 10% for the property manager? I mean, 9 times out of 10 now, my hourly wage only relates to deal making.
Yep.
Or raising capital, because it just doesn't make sense for me as the owner to be out there swinging a hammer. And I'm not good at it either. I mean,
which I think is kind of a blessing in a way for me. Like I have some friends and acquaintances that are very handy, and I think it's harder for them
to let go because they can do it.
Yeah. They go, I can do this and I can do it for a lot less. For me, it was very quick, like, wow, very worth it to hire someone.
So, well, because I did a few jobs myself, and then I had to hire somebody to come in and fix it. So now it was like, really, what you said before, it's time and money, but it's time and money again. So it's the compound. So, I mean, everybody talks about building wealth, generational wealth, things like that. You mentioned Rich Dad, Poor Dad. I was with Robert Kiyosaki and his team down in Dallas a couple months ago. And
awesome.
Great experience. The guy, he definitely opened up my eyes. That's kind of the trigger that pushed me into this space as well. But I didn't jump into it like you did. You started with the passive income side. I worked in fix and flip for almost 10 years before we decided to start buying large multifamily and self-storage complexes.
Sure.
And hindsight being what it is, you know, everybody says start with the end in mind. You know, it sounds like, you know, you kind of had that vision way earlier than we did. We wrongly told ourselves that we needed to have experience in smaller real estate before we got into big real estate.
Sure.
So creating generational wealth is great, but you can't, you have to make sure that you're not focused on a transactional business where you just do a deal once, it pays you once, and then you have to go on to find another one. Your rentals, they pay you every month. I mean, so
exactly
that passivity, and that you can compound off of that, right? You can grow over time, and one becomes two and two becomes four and four becomes 175 units. And now all of a sudden your passive income stream, pretty significant and tangible to be able to pass on to family and friends, and right, like you get to do something with that long term.
No, exactly right. And it's, you know, it was really out of necessity that I focused on that cash flow. So when I had shut my nutrition store down in 2008, and my first son was born, and I was kind of frantically going, hey, what do I do? And I took all these odd and end jobs. I eventually landed this minimum wage job in a high school special education class. And, you know, and my heart goes out to those kids and such. And I had a brother that kind of went through the special ed, school system. But like a couple months into that job, like I knew real quick, like this is not what I was put here to do. This is not my dream job. And so I was dead set. Like I needed cash flow to replace that job. To that first seller financing deal I did, it was two duplexes side by side. It cash flowed to the dollar, almost to the dollar that I was making at that job. And so I quit working. I finished out that year, but I quit working when I was only about $1,500 less. It was like $1,350 something, you know, cash flow positive. So I became financially free very quick.
Yeah,
it's amazing. $1,300, you know, a month positive cash flow isn't wealthy yet, but it gave me time. It gave me that time freedom to go put more deals together. And so even though I achieved that financial freedom really fast, I really saw the value of cash flow. So I lived really frugally for a lot of years, but sure, I owned my time to go put together the next deal, the next deal, the next deal. I think it would have been easy to think, well, now I have this cash flow, plus I have this job, and so my income is doubled. But I decided, hey, what's more important, that income doubling, which still wasn't a lot of money, or not work, have that little bit of income that I was, the same amount that I was making at the job, I just don't have a job now, and I can go have the time to put more deals. And so I don't think I would have had the time and energy to put those other deals together had I not stopped working then. And so that was a real pivotal point in my life.
Yeah, it's a great point for our listeners too, is like, you know, you want to get financially free, but all that really means is that you can replace your income to the point of your expenses. So key number one, and my wife and I, you know, we were blessed to do this as well. We figured out how to live off of one income very early.
Yep.
So that when we had kids and she didn't want to go back to work, we still lived frugally off of one income, but we knew what our expenses were and they were very low. So to become financially free was much easier than, you know, becoming wealthy, but you can't become wealthy without becoming financially free. And I don't believe
exactly
that you can straddle two boats and still work, you know, full time at one and full time at the other and still continue to grow. So first step, let's replace our income. Second step, let's continue to build on that to create some serious wealth.
Yeah, no, exactly right. I get into some interesting conversations because I've had some like high salary earners reach out and they're like, I want to be financially free. I want to replace this income. And it's in a lot of ways, it's very achievable for sure, but it's challenging if you're used to living off of $200,000 a year.
Right.
That's kind of your baseline. Then that's a big number to replace in passive income where, you know, you're very differently than you're talking a couple thousand dollars a month.
So that's right. Yeah.
But it's doable. I've seen many do it. So
yeah, I've seen guys do that too. And people do reach out to us too, right? I mean, we have some investors with us that are doctors, lawyers, anesthesiologists, things like that.
Yep.
And they get the fact that they have traded time for money, you know? Yep. And you know, I always joke like I'm the class mom for my first grader, right? Like I go in and do cupcakes and all the fun stuff. But like that's the freedom that comes along with that passive income. So yeah, I mean, these high income earners, they do get used to a lifestyle and it's almost automatic, right? Their paychecks are monthly. They've created the lifestyle up to their salary point. So maybe there's a little jarring effect that needs to take place in years one and two to start building that off. But if you want to spend time on a beach with your family, right, you can't also be going to work 80 hours a week. So
you gotta
figuring out how to trade time for money. Kiyosaki always talks about, you know, go to school, get a good job, and then invest in stocks, bonds, mutual funds, and ETFs. You know, I think now's a perfect time to recognize even what's going on with Wall Street in the past 30 days, right? It's down 30%. Yesterday it was up 500 points. The jobless claims doubled and this week this market went up. Like for me, I always say this, hope is not a strategy. I don't know how to plan a retirement with that type of volatility. I don't think anybody can effectively. You know, they always talk about dollar cost averaging and well, over time it will make, you know, over 30 or 40 years it will make this. You know, the whole reason that we started the Free From Wall Street podcast is because when my dad passed away, it was just after the market crash and he lost half of his wealth in the market and then didn't live to ride the market back up. So you can't plan your retirement around what the market will do over 40 years, right? I mean, you need to create consistency and cash flow, and you can do that through alternative investments and you can do it very well in a stable environment. I mean, people always need a place to live, right? So
no, absolutely. I mean, to me, just the concept of work forever, you know, work until you're really old, all day, every day. Right. And then statistically, how many people, you know, pass away right after retirement? They never get to enjoy that time. They never get to enjoy, if they did build up any kind of wealth through, you know, retirement account or stock market, they don't get to enjoy that. And to me, it was like, gosh, that is not the way. And in general, if the masses are doing it, I'm going to question it. And
you
know, just that thought of like work, and then you never get to enjoy it. You know, and to me, real estate made sense. Like, hey, you can have positive cash flow. You can live off of this investment income and live a life you want. You know, early on for me, it was, I thought it was about just building wealth, but then I realized how valuable, you know, we talked about it earlier, how valuable time is, because some people, I think, truly love that grind. Like they're going to work no matter how much wealth they have. They're going to work all day, every day. They love it. But that's not me. I want to be at a beach with my family. I enjoy, you know, traveling. I enjoy being able to take my kids to school and pick them up and be at their events. And that's really valuable to me. And that's that time freedom aspect that, you know, you don't get if you're trading your time for dollars. And so I think just being aware of what's important to you and then structuring your life accordingly is,
and that's the key, huge. Right? Talk about your core values, right? What do you value for your life and what do you want out of it? And then back into that. I mean, family, everybody always says, my why is my family. Well, if that's true, right, you should want to spend a lot less time at work. And
exactly.
There's ways to do that. You know, we're talking about potentially next year jumping in an RV and just driving around the country and seeing some sights. And let's teach my daughter about the Grand Canyon at the Grand Canyon, right? And we're on the East Coast and like, and you can do the stuff like that. It's not impossible. So cool, man. I love your story. It's awesome. I think it will inspire a lot of people to recognize like, hey, you don't need to know everything to get started. right? There's ways to figure it out without money or credit or, you know, big down payments. So there's all these different places to start. The key is just start.
Yeah. If you want it bad, and I mean, if you want it bad enough, you'll find a way. I mean, when I got started, I didn't know how, but there was that strong why. So that's what I tell anybody. If you want it bad enough, you'll find a way.
Awesome. Cool, man. Well, thank you so much for taking your time, and we'll definitely keep in touch. Oh, where can people reach out to you if they want to reach out to you? Where are you going to be speaking? Yeah. I know that you have some engagements coming up. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah. The best way to reach me is through Instagram at Gabriel Hamill or Gabriel R. Hamill. You'll find me. And I have a website, hamillinvestments.com, but I'd say Instagram's the best way. There was a Veterans Live event that's going online at the end of May, and I'll post some stuff online as the details of that comes out.
Cool. So you guys are taking basically an event. It's going to be geared towards veterans, but it's open to everybody, right?
Correct.
My buddy Bill Allen is part of the speaker lineup, and there's a lot of really cool guys that we've had on the podcast even recently to talk about this stuff. And when is that?
It's the end of May. So 27th through, I think, the 30th or 20. I'm not sure the exact dates, but I'll make sure I post it.
And yeah. And we'll put them in our show notes here too, once we get it. So yeah, go over to that Veterans Live event, check it out. We're all going to be locked into our houses for the next couple of weeks at least anyway. So might as well learn how to get financially free and free from Wall Street. So thanks everybody for listening. And thank you once again, Gabriel. Appreciate you, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Thank you for listening. Like what you hear? Be sure to subscribe and head over to freefromwallstreet.com and sign up for our free guides to help you and your family invest with purpose.